dedication to Professor Akasufu.
Thank you, Carl. Ladies and gentlemen, today is really a very, very memorable occasion. On the one hand, we acknowledge for the first time the first endowed chair for the University of Alaska system, and I guess I would like to extend my thanks to many of you who provided very able assistance in achieving this. Secondly, and even more importantly, the Sidney Chapman Chair in Physical Sciences will be awarded to one of our own, Dr. Shin Akasofu. Dr. Akasofu came to the university many years ago as a student of Sidney Chapman, followed in his line, and has achieved excellence in his own right that probably goes beyond that of even his mentor. We would, this afternoon, like to honor Dr. Akasofu by naming him the first Sidney Chapman Professor of Physical Sciences. Dr. Akasofu, would you come forward? Whereas Dr. Shinichi Akasofu has distinguished himself as a student and later as a faculty member of the University of Alaska Fairbanks in the area of physical sciences, and whereas Dr. Shinichi Akasofu has conducted years of productive research on the aurora and taught space physics at the University of Alaska Fairbanks since 1961, and by 1981 had become one of the 1,000 most cited scientists in the world, and whereas Dr. Shinichi Akasofu has been prolific in his writings, which include 8 books as author or co-author, author of 3 invited encyclopedia articles, and author of more than 400 referee journal articles, and whereas Dr. Shinichi Akasofu has willingly shared his ideas and knowledge, and through his excellence in teaching and research, and his prominent international reputation, has attracted students and faculty of distinction to the institution, and whereas Dr. Shinichi Akasofu's presence at the University of Alaska Fairbanks has helped to build and improve its internationally known space physics group and has substantially helped to enhance the reputation of the Geophysical Institute, and whereas Dr. Shinichi Akasofu established the concept of auroral substorms on the basis of data gathered in part from all sky photographs in 1957 and 1958, and went on to show that the global auroral activity has with regularity and to establish the flow pattern of intense electric currents in the ionosphere during substorms, and whereas Dr. Shinichi Akasofu has been awarded the prestigious Chapman Medal of the Royal Astronomical Society, and whereas Dr. Shinichi Akasofu received his Doctor of Philosophy degree at the University of Alaska under the tutorage of Sidney Chapman, and the chair in the physical sciences established by the state of Alaska has since been named the Sidney Chapman Chair in the Physical Sciences, now therefore be it resolved that the University of Alaska Fairbanks hereby acknowledges with great pleasure Dr. Shinichi Akasofu as the first recipient of the Sidney Chapman Chair in the Physical Sciences and declares this act a fitting tribute to Sidney Chapman's most accomplished student, and be it further resolved that this resolution be appropriately engrossed and conveyed to Dr. Shinichi Akasofu on February 7th, 1986. Dr. Akasofu, congratulations. To commemorate the event, I'm going to turn it over to Dr. Jayaweer in just a moment, but I do need to note the fact that this afternoon will be the first of an annual seminar series in honor of Sidney Chapman. And immediately following Dr. Akasofu's lecture, we do have an informal reception and music played by our own student group in the Great Hall. So I would invite you all to welcome and share with Dr. Akasofu. Thank you.
Distinguished Professor Akasufo, Chancellor O'Rourke, and ladies and gentlemen, in politics, as in war and in business, men show the fighting instincts that we share with animal creations. But in our powers of cooperation, as in our powers of learning, we far surpass our fellow living creatures. Moreover, we can consciously look at ourselves and see our imperfections. We can strive to learn, to lessen them. This striving, this learning can be a lifelong for each one of us. For mankind as a whole, it can continue from generation to generation. Looking back to man's past, what developments we see. We cannot probe the future, but humanly speaking, we can rest our greatest hopes in this international, this universal adventure in learning. These words, ladies and gentlemen, were spoken during the commencement address at University of Michigan, January 1960, by Professor Sidney Chapman. At the recommendation of the faculty of this campus, the University Board of Regents established the first ever endowed chair of this university system in his name. It is in memory of him that the College of Natural Sciences initiates an annual lecture to be given by a distinguished physical scientist. I would like to take this opportunity to talk to you a little bit about Sidney Chapman. Professor Chapman was a mathematician, physicist, geophysicist, and above all, an educator. He laid the foundation of modern solar terrestrial physics and introduced the scientific discipline of aeronomy. In fact, that word has still got into the Webster's dictionary. Around the world, he has honored at many scientific institutions and universities with awards, medals, and honorary degrees, including a Doctor of Science from UAF. The most prestigious honor bestowed on him was his selection as a fellow of the Royal Society of Great Britain. This society is an exclusive society reserved for the best scientists in Britain and whose founding president was none other than Sir Isaac Newton. Sidney Chapman was the most distinguished professor associated with the University of Alaska. His inspiration and dedication brought many science students to this campus. The central role he played in organizing the International Geophysical Year, IGY, propelled the Geophysical Institute along a path that made it one of the world's leading and unique research centers for geophysics. When Dr. Chapman joined the Infant Geophysical Institute in 1951, Dr. Akasufo once told me that at that time, Geophysical Institute had two masters, Chapman and Elway, and a bunch of boys. These boys carried their master's inspiration and made the institute what it is today. The boys included some of our professors here, Professor Neil Davis, Professor Gene Westcott, Professor Chuck Tier, Professor Al Bellone, and Professor Partha Sarathy. I forgive you if I fail to mention everyone in this list here. And above all, the most illustrious of them all was Dr. Akasufo. Dr. Akasufo joined the Geophysical Institute as a student of Professor Chapman and received his PhD from University of Alaska in 1961. He became a professor of geophysics 3 years later in 1964. He followed in the footsteps of Professor Chapman and carried on the study of geomagnetic studies and aurora, inspiring many students at this university. His research publications in refereed journals exceed 400, as Chancellor O'Rourke alluded earlier, which is approximately 14 per year continuously for the past 28 years. It was once said by Roger Smith at the Geophysical Institute, that if you collect the individual pages of all his publications and books, we can place them end to end, they will pave the path of Halley's Comet. Halley took 75 years to do that, though. Professor Akasufo epitomizes that the quality of excellence that any great international university must have in his faculty. He's a dedicated teacher, rigorous yet compassionate. His teaching methods resemble walking with his students into areas of uncharted map so that his teaching and research fuse together. In spite of his extremely busy schedule of research and teaching, he heads the physics department and travels around the state giving lectures to various high schools among them. In fact, he did return yesterday from Anchorage, and I was told that instead of giving one lecture, he gave 6 lectures within 1 year to different high school students. We are truly fortunate to have Shin with us, and I invite him now to deliver the first Sidney Chapman Memorial Lecture. The subject of his talk is Creativity in Science, Arts, and Business. Ladies and gentlemen, the distinguished chair professor, Shin Ishi Akasufo.
I'm greatly honored to have been selected as the first recipient of the Sidney Chapman Chair. And I would like to thank the University of Alaska and the Board of Regents for this great honor. In particular, I would like to thank Chancellor O'Rourke, Dean Kofje-Aware, and the Chapman Chair Committee for their several years of intensive effort in establishing this chair. Because of time limitation, perhaps I should go straight into my talk. But just let me say at the outset that I'm recently telling my colleagues that I'm developing a bad habit of giving talks on some subjects I don't know very much about. And unfortunately, this is one of those. So many things, but some of the things I'll say today are plain wrong. And some of them could be outrageous even. So bear in mind, and saying that, I guess I feel a little easy. So let me go on to the slide. The first slide. The subject I'm going to talk about is creativity in science, arts, and business. And in science, the creativity, the creation is defined in this way. The creation in science consists of perceiving a new thought pattern on the basis of already available data and theories. Well, another way of expressing it is that noticing a new thought pattern or a connection between things where no connection was thought before, has been thought before, things like that. And with this definition, perhaps Charles Darwin was perhaps one of the most creative scientists in the history of science. And by that I mean, for example, he says that something like, what can be more curious than that wing of bats, or paddle of porpoise, or leg of horse, or leg or or hand of the man that for digging, grabbing. If you look at just that, they look completely different, but Darwin was the one to notice that the basic structures of these things are very similar. So he noticed that the connection among things have been found or thought before. Of course, Darwin is, of course, one of the first scientists who conceived the concept of the evolution of life. And by this, I mean that we are surrounded by many living creatures, the creatures, single-cell organism, or starfish, or horse, or dogs, or scorpions, or mushrooms, or fungus, or algae. For us, they don't look like that, they're not really connected in any way, but he was one of the first to recognize that they are connected indeed, and that perhaps they evolved from single-cell organism. And of course, this is a hypothesis. No one can see the evolution of life, But nevertheless, this is one of the greatest creation of the human mind. Newton was also very creative, and one of the perhaps easiest example is that the motion of planets, what they used to call heavenly bodies, the motion of up on the ground, the same. In other words, he recognized the connection between the two things, that one is planet, one is apple, and their motions are connected by just a single equation there, the force of gravity. So this is the creation, this is creativity in science. This is an art, of course, flower arranging. And again, I think we can extend that same kind of definition to art, that the people doing art are not necessarily creating flowers, but they have already existing flowers, and put them into some kind of arrangement to come up with a creative expression. This is one of Shakespeare's famous sonnet. Again, Shakespeare was not creating any words, rather putting all these words into a specific form, the poem. This is one of the most beautiful poems in Chinese history. And sorry, you can't read it, and I can't read it either. But it's really one of the most, I think, that I like most. And again, this poet, a particular poet, Du Fu, wasn't creating any Chinese characters, rather using existing characters, he came up with this beautiful poem. Similarly, Chopin, he was not creating a new piano board, keyboard. He was using existing keyboard and come up with his own music. So this is the creativity in music. Creativity in business is, again, very similar in that the definition will be that the putting existing product together, you come up with a new product. This is called, of course, as you know, radio cassette. And putting radio and cassette together, you have a new product which sell more than just the radio or cassette, the separate. This is another example that the changing trend in the camera industry, that now camera industry, they are competing with the computer that they put it in, the camera. That is to say, the days of competition lens over now, and so that the new competition is putting a computer into the camera system. This is a Canon advertisement, and nowhere you see the word camera here. And in fact, they stress that image processor. So this is the way that business is going, and this is a creativity, in a sense, in business. The word processor is another creation in business. What the Wong did, the company did, is to combine typewriter and the television tube or cathode ray tube and computer to come up with what we now call word processor. So this is a business creation. This is a robot. This particular robot can read a musical note and play music. The robot is, by this definition that we're using, is a creation in industry or business. And I saw this picture in the music department the other day with a note that we may lose a job. A new wave of business automation or office automation is coming. And this is one of those that, again, you can see that the what they call OA, automation of business, the administration is a combination of many computers or computer-oriented product. And again, this is a path we might call business creation. Now, why do we create? Of course, I'm not a philosopher, so I don't really want to philosophize. I would like to go in the simplest, naive way. I think we create because we like to express something. And let's take the case of the aurora. And when you see the aurora, of course, you're fascinated by it, and the artist painted. This is one of the most famous paintings of Sidney Lawrence. This is the way so artists paint. This is the way that musicians express their feeling about the aurora. This is Gordon Lights, Ursa Major, and Gordon kindly showed me the portion of that musical note and the portion that he expressed the aurora. In fact, it might look like the aurora there too. this is one of the most beautiful poems of the aurora. Again, the poet see whatever, you know, the most impressive to him, and express in this particular way. How do scientists do in this? This is an example. Scientists use extensively the equations. And this is their way of expressing nature. But the so the method is, you know, we use artists or scientists are different, but what they try to do is very similar. That is to say, we like to express something about the nature in this particular case and the many other cases too. Now, I guess there's a little problem in the equations most of people hate to see even. But we scientists think that equations are beautiful. This is, of course, the well-known Maxwell's equation. I think this is the most beautiful set of differential equations. And I can see why some people put this one on T-shirts. I can see the wisdom of that. But if you don't understand the equations, that's fine for scientists. Artists, if you don't understand the equations, that's fine. For example, I don't think everybody appreciates this kind of picture. Some people like it, and some people don't like it. So equation, if you don't see any beauty, that's okay. And also that we scientists or anybody else, you know, have a different taste or something. And in this case, again, it's the Picasso's painting. You may or you may not like the same way. And some people might like classical music, and young people like music like that, and or some people don't think that even that this is music, but this is the way it goes. So we have different tastes, and so I'm not particularly upset that if someone cannot see the beauty in the equations. Now, I think there is some myth about scientists, and I would like to clear up. This is a good time to do it. This is a myth that many people have about the scientists, and even scientists among themselves. Many people think the scientists are extremely objective, and artists are not. And I say this is not so. Here is the bench, the Mona Lisa. And of course, we didn't have an opportunity to ask Picasso to paint Mona Lisa, but I'm sure that if he painted will look like that, perhaps. Of course, this is just my guess. Okay, so many people say that the scientists in particular, that artists are very subjective. It's really so, and the scientists are objective. It is really so. I say it's not. For example, this is the picture of the coverage of ice of the northern North American continent during Ice Age. And I understand that there are at least 70 theories on the formation of Ice Age, the cause of the Ice Age. And they're very, very different. So this means that we are not necessarily objective. Another example would be like extinction of dinosaurs. In this particular picture, that some scientists assume that dinosaur extinction was produced by the impact of meteorites. And I understand that there are, again, many, many theories or ideas about extinction of dinosaurs. One of them that told by a scientist who visited us last year from Berkeley, that one idea is that was that a butterfly killed the dinosaurs. The idea was that the caterpillars ate up all the plants and the dinosaur got hungry and died. But that, this is not ridiculous. It's a serious idea. So scientists have a very number of ideas, and at this point, I can't say they are objective. They have their own way of extracting what's most essential and then come up with their theory. In terms of equations, we do this quite often. The top one in the box is the equation of motion of gas or fluid. Then what we do is usually simplify the equation because we can't solve that one for many circumstances. So the first one, we say that we assume a steady state and then simplify the equation we try to solve. And second one, we say steady state, and then J cross B, the electromagnetic force, is small, so let's ignore. And then any other force, F, we ignore, so we come up with a very simple equation. Or we can, there are some people, depending on the situations, of course, say steady state, pressure gradient is zero, small, the gravitational field is small, any other force is small, and then we finally come up to J cross B equals zero. That's a simplification. So we try to solve that particular equation. So this is almost like abstract painting, that you look at an object and then try to see what's most essential in the object, and then you either paint or you try to describe the object by equations. And in general, what we do is to eliminate many terms, in this case, as many terms as possible, and anything left, what you think is most essential. So in this sense, we are not really objective. We are very subjective. Another example is the spiral arm galaxy. This fascinates the people. And of course, again, many, many ideas. And using the equation in the previous slide, for example, some scientists did a big computer simulation. Here you can see that this particular scientist, Ho, assumes perhaps the 10,000 particles, and that they are gravitationally interacting. And then he rotates this system and see by simulating the motion. And he finally got spiral arm, just like a galaxy. And so this was his theory. And it so happened that this theory was wrong. What's happened is that, like our Milky Way galaxy, it has rotated already more than 50 times. And if you, this is only just a few rotations. And if you rotate this one, continue this simulation for 60 rotations, the whole thing just fall apart. So this theory happened to be wrong. And the scientist could become very objective when he set the basic assumptions or they select a model. Then he becomes very objective. In this computation with an accuracy of computer, this author must be doing extremely accurate job. So I think the scientists are very subjective when they choose a model. But once the model is chosen, they become very objective. So I'd like to eliminate some of the myths that people have toward the scientists and the scientists among themselves. This is the what we call the density wave theory of formation of galactic arms. This is now most popular. I don't have time to go into, but the previous one happened to be wrong, and this is more likely to be the situation. Now, in business or in science or arts, very important thing is to be creative and innovative. And it so happened that it's ironic that the ongoing, in the case of business, the ongoing successful business is the most serious obstacle for new innovation. This is just an example of watchmaking. And when the watchmaking comes to this kind of stage, it's almost an art. You can't distinguish between art and perhaps business. A really beautiful thing, and obviously we salute to the effort. It so happened that around the end of the 1960s, that some Swiss watchmaker proposed a digital watch. But most of the Swiss watchmakers took that to be an insult to their profession, because they have been doing this for years, and they've been successful, and interest in improving this mechanical watch that they just couldn't think of a digital watch to be even a watch. And it was actually Seiko that took the idea and dominated the digital watch world. In science, again, very similar, that the ongoing successful research is the most serious obstacle for innovation. This is explained very well by Thomas Kuhn, a scientific philosopher, in his book, The Structure of the Scientific Revolution. This was written in 1962. In this book, Kuhn introduced the term paradigm. Apparently, it is a Greek word meaning examples or exercise in the textbooks. The many textbooks, scientific textbook, at the end of each chapter, you have examples or exercise that you are supposed to go through and run polish what you have run in each chapter. The reason that Kuhn used this particular term for this purpose is that those examples are guaranteed to be solvable. This point will become very clear in a minute. Now, Kuhn also says that there's a good analogy between the paradigm and the jigsaw puzzle. So let's suppose that there's the group of scientists trying to solve jigsaw puzzle, the Garfield jigsaw puzzle. Then we might call this group Garfield paradigm, that everyone in this paradigm think that this is the only thing to solve, and you're not supposed to think it's anything other than Garfield. So really try hard to solve this jigsaw puzzle. And For example, that there is a field in the chemical, say, the evolution of life, or origin of life on Earth, there is a particular school of thought that what they call chemical evolution. That is to say, whole life began in the inorganic field. That is to say, they assume that, the group of scientists assume that the very primitive Earth had ammonia, methane, and water. And somehow, from this, the three gases, the life, the evolved, the originated, and evolved. So this is the basic assumption. It's like a Garfield puzzle. They assume that on the basis of that assumption, they work and they try to solve the origin of life. And eventually, some of the scientists succeeded in producing amino acid, the very basic element of life, by having a discharge. So this is, say, like a Garfield paradigm. The group of scientists in this field had this agreed assumption and tried to understand or solve the problem, the origin of life. And you're not, when you're doing this, you're not supposed to think of something else. For example, this is the one of the very interesting meteorites called carbonaceous chondrite. It has quite a bit of amino acid in it. And we know that the Earth was bombarded by meteorite in the early stage, but between 4.6 and 4 billion years ago. And very likely that some of those carbonaceous chondrite brought some amino acid. And however, once you set to chemical evolution of life, you're not supposed to think about that kind of possibility. Another example of the Newtonian mechanics. I'm sorry to use all the equations, but equations is very simple in a sense that second equation simply says that when you're running with extremely high speed, very close to the speed of light, your watch will slow down. But you're not supposed to think about that, as that watch will take the time as you are sitting. Last equation simply says that you're not supposed to think that mass will be this energy. So assuming that simply those you try to solve the problems not only in rockets or those, but try to solve the problems in the subatomic structure. Again, the same thing that even in art, for arranging, there is a very definite school, some schools, and the way of arranging flowers, you cannot do it very arbitrary. You have to have follow some particular mode of arranging. Well, actually, the actual real world in science is not like the jigsaw puzzle you saw earlier. It's very much like that. Number one, there are so many missing pieces. And number two, there are always some odd pieces. And there are many ways that to deal with odd pieces. Here, the one you see, the black and white piece, you could throw away the saying that this is not the Garfield puzzle. That's what many scientists do, throw it away. Or a second way of doing it is that you try to put it in, you try hard and somehow try to find the place to put it in. And some people even use the scissors to put it in. You're not supposed to do it, and if you don't do that, but somehow, as Kuhn said, that in terms of paradigm, it's like exercise and examples, so the solution is guaranteed. So many people spend lots of time try to find where this abnormal piece might fit. And some people might spend even 20 years. Nothing wrong in that. And in fact, when scientists are doing this sort of action, the period that during which he or a group of scientists doing this is called the normal science. It's completely normal and nothing wrong in it. This is, as far as I'm concerned, a very interesting odd piece. Of course, I'm not a biologist, so I can't tell the difference between this and Alaska mosquitoes. To me, it's a very well-developed mosquito. This is actually the found in a fossil. And if Darwin's evolution theory of evolution is correct, then there should be a little less developed mosquito and in the earlier geologic time. And if you dig a little further, you'll find even less developed mosquitoes. And they have not been found yet. And so one way, this is the odd piece, in a sense. And of course, one way is to be in this, the paradigm of evolution of life and try to find how such an insect has evolved from something. And you really work hard to try to find some fossil traces. This is definitely one way. This is normal science. Nothing wrong in it. Or it could be that this is so old piece that you like to throw away. And when you're doing this, you're not supposed to think that the insect came from outer space or anything like that. Although, when you look at the electron microscope photograph of Alaska mosquito, it looks like it invaded the Earth from, it came from outer space someplace. But you're not supposed to do that. But actually, to me, real world in science is just like that. You really don't know what particular jigsaw puzzle is. And if you start to think that this is the Garfield paradigm, you know, the group of scientists begin to think that it looks as if it's a Garfield paradigm. Or some other scientists might think, no, it's not. It's including some other pieces that the whole thing fit better with something else. Like a Snoopy puzzle. That's another way of thinking. And in fact, the scientists move from one paradigm to another. This is what Thomas Kuhn called paradigm switch, or what he called the scientific revolution. This is perhaps the best example of a scientific revolution, in a sense. The switches from Newtonian mechanics to special theory of relativity. And what Einstein did was synthesis, again, creation. All the data existed before him. He did not rely on any new observations. There's some argument about it, but as far as I know, he did not rely on the Michelson Morley experiment. Rather, the things didn't fit well to his mind. And what he did is, let's assume that a velocity of light, a C is universal constant, and then resynthesize whole Newtonian mechanics with that, and eventually came up with MC squared equal E, which is one of the most famous equations that mass is energy. Now, in a sense that what the scientists are doing is perhaps best described by this kind of a diagram, a very simplified, extremely simplified case. We scientists tend to go to a very small portion of a whole object. Here, you see, there may be a group of scientists looking at a very small portion of a circle and claim that with extremely high accuracy, that portion is a straight line. And that we do all the time. And until somebody point out that, no, you're looking at only a very small portion of a circle. So this is the way science progress. So in a sense that there is a little difference between science and art is that the science is accumulative. That is to say, we're going, let's see, I can't go back, so let me just say the Newtonian mechanics to special theory relativity. There is nothing wrong in that. Newtonian mechanics is simply the approximation of a special theory relativity. So one good thing about science is that it's accumulative. Our knowledge is accumulative. And in arts, maybe, I'm sure it's a matter of degree. But nevertheless, in science, we build up the now I learned that in the business world, there have been some revolution going rather quietly or so, rather quietly. And this is the book, Peters and the Waterman and the Search of Excellence. In it, they introduce also, take the word from Kuhn, a paradigm, and they talk about a paradigm switch. They describe the changes of the management in terms of paradigm switches. And they now, in a new book, they say talk about new leadership, and they think that the leadership in the middle of a triangle, which consists of people and innovation and care of customers. So like old image of American management, that the best example for ITT, there's a major change that appears to be going in this business world. Perhaps, I don't know if you can read this. I can't read this either. But this is perhaps one of the most important pieces of a document. This appeared in People's Daily in Beijing about 2-3 years ago. And this statement is very interesting that, of course, their country, they have a big paradigm, in a sense, perhaps the biggest paradigm in the whole human history is the Marxism or communism, and everybody trying to polish it and improve it, just like in normal science. But in the statement, however, their government make a statement that they are going to introduce a little bit of a capitalism. I don't know exactly how it's worded because I can't read Chinese well enough. And so this is creativity. Again, there are no connection before that the communism, capitalism, Marxism, capitalism. Now they are trying to combine a little bit. So this statement is much more, to me, important than the Mikhail Gorbachev that making a speech a couple of days ago in Moscow. There, he's still trying to polish the Marxism. Within the Marxism, he's trying to improve the system. But here, this is very definitely different, that is to say, they introduce something that there's no connection was thought before. So this is perhaps a creativity in politics. Now I'd like to summarize the whole thing. This is often the way that scientists or business cooperation would like to go through. You plan and then gather data and analyze and synthesize and come to a conclusion. In the case of science, in the business, maybe action. Now, one thing to me that even the scientists don't do very much is synthesis. They are so happy to plan and gather data analyze, and then stop there. In fact, when you talk about in general scientists, you know, their statement always, we analyze data. And I think the term synthesis really is not been talked about too often. And somehow, synthesis isn't there. And I think we have to teach more of a synthesis, because this is the creativity. You see, after all that, definitely going back to the definition of creativity, in science, it's a synthesis. And the scientific revolution is nothing but a new synthesis. And something that we are not teaching students too well on this. We are so busy in data gathering, and somehow we tend to forget the synthesis. And this is also often the case in business too, in the business cooperation. There are many patterns. They are so happy to, you know, they so much involved in planning, and they don't do anything after that. And I hope that this university 6-year plan wouldn't end up like that. Data gathering. Okay, some people do data gathering to keep them busy. And because there's no planning, so data gathering is not systematic, so that's the only place he gets, and that's the end. He collects a whole bunch of data for nothing. And many companies do too. You know, gets customer information. They don't do anything because there's no planning how to use it. And the third category is that they do a planning and data gathering, but somehow they don't do either analysis or synthesis. And the saddest case is that particularly very large corporations, that management, they are extremely strong without leadership. They go tremendous planning, data gathering, analysis, and then go into paralysis. That is to say, it's what Iacocca, I guess, described in his autobiography, that the company turned into a paper mill or a publishing company. They come up with a fancy covers with all kinds of document and, you know, analyze the market to death. And somehow there's no one to take action, and the whole thing ends there. And unfortunately, many of the failing big companies are really doing this. So now, this is supposed to be, of course, the Chapman Memorial Lecture. So I'd like to say a few words about Sidney Chapman. In one word, perhaps we could say that he was a founding father of a study of the electromagnetic environment around the Earth. Perhaps that's, to me, the best way to describe him. He was a founding father of this particular field, which include, of course, study of the aurora, because aurora is an electrical discharge phenomenon, and definitely something to do with electromagnetic environment around the Earth. And of course, one of the reasons that Chapman came here was to study the aurora, and he really fascinated by the aurora. And he used to tell me that regardless of hours of night, he asked me to wake him up whenever there was a good aurora. 1 o'clock, 2 o'clock, apparently didn't matter to him. So I used to knock his door after midnight. This is one picture I happen to have. Good old days, the Pan American used to fly to Fairbanks, and Sidney Chapman, Catherine Chapman came together. You can see all kinds of things, goodies there. They used to buy lots of stuff in Seattle. They thought that in the Fairbanks, all the prices are outrageous. So they carried lots of stuff with them. This is only one picture I happen to have. He and I were working together. I believe that's perhaps 1965 or so. Now, I happen to have a very interesting tape, and I want you to hear. He talked about, just in 2-3 minutes of his talk, this is a part of his talk, that the biographical talk, and he talked about Reynolds first, and of course, you know the Reynolds, the famous Reynolds number. Then he go to Charles, Lamb. He was perhaps the first person who came up with a treaty on hydrodynamics. And then he talk about very inexperienced young teacher from Cambridge, Littlewood. So let's listen to his tape, just 2-3 minutes. And so this is teacher evaluation time, and if you feel that you did a good job, you could mention perhaps that, you know, you expose the difficulty to a bright student. And I'm sure that Chancellor Orok will approve of that. Thank you very much.